All right. We have the in re, the reinternment of the remains of Kirill Feyenoff. Counsel, please.
May it please the court. My name is Karen Bertram. I represent Marina Braun in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Proceed then.
Marina Braun asks this court to reverse the trial court's dismissal of her petition for reinterment and remand the case for a fair trial on the merits. If Ms. Braun had been permitted discovery in this case, there would have been a much different result.
Why does it matter? Where does she get authority to make the decision, assuming the best discovery you can get?
She is one of the hierarchical members under the statute that is allowed to make the decision about interment if the decedent here himself does not.
So if she, just because she's in the list, she can make it. So if she wins, can someone else in the list then start again and reverse that and we can start moving the body around?
No, Your Honor.
Why? First one in?
No, it's not the first one in. The first one in priority is the surviving spouse, which is what happened here. But when there is a disagreement among family members about interment, then it's left to the equitable balancing of the court.
For your argument to prevail, the following has to be true. The surviving spouse who is allowed to make the decision as to where the remains go, if the decedent has not pre-planned or made his wishes, his or her wishes known pursuant to the statute, the surviving spouse is allowed to make that decision for any reason whatsoever or for no reason at all. She makes that decision and the burial is on Tuesday. On Wednesday, your client is able to come in, and notwithstanding that the same statute requires the surviving spouse to have paid the cost of burial and maintenance into perpetuity as a condition of exercising her discretion, you get to start again with no presumptions and no indication that the legislature picked winners and losers when it created a hierarchy. You got to be able to come in on Wednesday, the next day, in order for if that's not so, you can't win, right?
I disagree that she would have to come in on Wednesday.
Well, no. I mean, she'd have to be able to come in on Wednesday and do it.
Correct. And I think she can.
And so that's what the legislature did. It picked winners and losers, and it put the surviving spouse in the second place after the decedent. But they required the surviving spouse to pay the cost of the internment for perpetuity, the cost of the eternal resting place. But they only meant to do it for maybe a day.
That's not correct, Your Honor. And the surviving spouse does not have an exclusive right. When there is disagreement,
it says that it's an exclusive right to determine where the burial is, right?
No, and I don't believe that's what the statute says.
Well, of course that's what it says. Okay, let me ask the question this way. Do we have to believe that the statute does not set forth an exclusive right in the surviving spouse when the decedent has not made wishes known to determine where the burial place should be?
No, and I think that to read the statute that way is to ignore the common law. And
well, the statute changed the common law. The common law talked about next of kin. And the legislature took those people who could be next of kin, surviving spouse, adult children, surviving parents, siblings, all could be next of kin. It took those people And as legislators sometimes do, it picked winners and losers. And it created a hierarchy of surviving spouse, adult children, parents, surviving siblings. That's just the legislature doing what the legislature does. And it says that the decision vests in the surviving spouse as the first person as to where the where burial is.
Correct.
And you're telling me that's not an exclusive right?
I'm telling you that the common law in Washington does not give an exclusive right to the surviving spouse.
No, that's
and
why
I
the
don't
legislature
believe,
passed a statute.
I believe that the statute and the common law must be read in harmony. I don't think that just because the legislature...
The common law said next of kin, the legislature took those that could be considered next of kin and created a hierarchy. Obviously, those cannot be harmonious. The legislature was supplanting the common law as it is wont to do by creating winners and losers, and that's what it did here.
But the statute also allows the court to override the decision of the surviving spouse. And that's exactly what the common law does, is it asks the court to weigh the equitable factors that are at play, and that didn't happen here.
What are the conditions for the court being involved? What are the conditions for the court being involved? Under 200, that's what you're talking about. Right?
Correct. Sorry, I don't have the statute memorized.
Well, the statute 160 says the right to control the disposition of the remains of a deceased person vests in the following order named, and surviving spouse is two clicks above surviving parents. So if that's a vested right, what in 200 gives the court the ability to disregard rather than act in harmony with the right vested in 160?
Well, what the statute says is if the required consent cannot be obtained, in this case from either the cemetery or the surviving spouse.
And it could be obtained. There was a cemetery authority and there was a surviving spouse. They could have consented.
Well, but isn't refusal to consent an inability to obtain it?
No, it's a refusal to consent. There's clearly an ability to consent. It can be obtained. It's just not forthcoming.
Well, I disagree. I think the argument is inconsistent.
If she had died, if the surviving spouse had died, there would be an inability to obtain her consent. Given that this is a statutory scheme that deals with things that are at common law, believed that will last for an eternity, that's a reasonable reading of what they're talking about there. People die. They're not around anymore to consent. If they can't consent, if their consent can't be obtained because they're not on earth anymore, then we move down the list. But here her consent could be obtained.
I think
she
that's
just
a narrow
chose
reading.
Not to. But it's consistent with 160, which gave her the right to have him buried there in the first place.
She did have that right.
And she had the obligation, when she exercised the right, to pay for it for an eternity. And there's nothing in 200 that says how she gets her money back if your cause of action has merit.
She didn't pay for it.
She caused it to be paid for. She had a gracious father who, at a time when her husband died, paid the cost. That happens. People are nice to each other every once in a while. Okay.
And you have 2 minutes on rebuttal, and the focus there is what is the scope of 200? That's certainly what our concern is. Counsel?
Your Honor, I'm Jack Zahner for the respondents, the Seeligs, and if I could, I would like to divide my time. I'd like to take 8 minutes and give 2 minutes to Temple Dersh.
Leave the responsibility to you to watch the clock.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sit down whenever you want, and she can stand up whenever you sit down.
Okay. Your Honor, respectfully, we agree with the line of questioning that the court
has advanced. Here's the procedural problem you seem to have. You brought a motion under 12b-6, arguing an entirely different theory. And then it got converted to a Rule 56 motion. Does the fact that you brought this on an entirely different theory preclude us from engaging in a decision in this court based on a request for relief other than the request for relief that you brought in the trial court?
I don't think so, Your Honor. This court may affirm on any basis appearing in the record. We brought the motion that there was no authority for the court to act given the statutory scheme. The surviving spouse made the choice of Seattle. It was a legitimate choice. It was a lawful choice. The couple met here, raised a family here.
Does that even matter?
And it doesn't. It doesn't. Her choice should be respected.
It would matter if he had made his wishes known, right?
Correct.
Because then she wouldn't be primary.
That is correct.
Okay.
But there should be no judicial
If he had made his wishes known, and if she acted inconsistent with those wishes, there would be a cause of action for somebody lower on this list bring an action, because they would be vindicating the decedent's interests, not their own, right?
I would agree. But there were no facts suggesting that here. And I think the other...
I'm just trying to see how we make sense of the statute.
And another circumstance where the court could intervene is if there was not a surviving spouse and, say, we're going down the list, if the adult children say there's two adult children and they disagree, it may be that the court has to intervene there.
And that would be the notice to the non-consenting for people.
Right, right.
Those
right.
that are not consenting would be the children in the minority or the parent who disagrees with the other parent.
Correct.
Right? And that would fit within 210.
Correct.
There was some argument that Mr. Seelig had the right to object because he paid for it. Do you agree that neither 160 nor 200 conveys any rights on him other than as an agent for someone authorized by statute?
I think that's correct that he paid for it as an agent for the surviving spouse. But then the surviving spouse has no rights. That's right.
He paid a debt that the statute assigns to another, and he did so as a volunteer.
That's right.
But he doesn't get any rights himself. It's still the rights in the person designated in the statute.
But the widow has those rights.
And if, God forbid, she had died, he would not be able to take her place just because he paid the money, because he wasn't the surviving spouse. Right?
I think that's consistent with the agency.
Is it your position that the statutory scheme supplants, and I'll use Ms. Dwyer's words, supplants the common law, or is in conflict, or can they be harmonized? Which of those three, and if you have a fourth alternative?
I think the statute was drafted to eliminate disputes like this. I think the statute was drafted to set forth a clear hierarchy, to set forth limitations on the court's ability to act. And in that sense, it does depart from the common law. It says, this is how we're going
to
do it.
So we shouldn't be trying to harmonize because it supplants, right?
Yes. I
used a rather crude euphemism, but it's often used with regard to what the legislature does. Do you agree that the legislature picked winners and losers amongst the next of kin?
Yes, the legislature did, and it's consistent with what the legislature has done in terms of choosing the hierarchy for health care decisions. It tracks, the next of kin, that tracks exactly how it's done in other contexts. And, even if we're looking at the procedural question that you asked, this court can affirm on any basis in the record. I think even if we were going to reach the equitable merits, the court here was very careful in saying to the petitioner in the order setting forth the briefing, you may submit whatever declarations you want that go towards...
We've got 638 pages of clerk's papers. Was there any time at trial, in the trial court, not at trial, in the trial court, where anybody raised to the judge a concern that they hadn't been able to attempt to explain how they believed the statutes work, not regard to specific facts of the case, but how the statutory mechanism works?
I don't believe so. And in fact, the trial court allowed the petitioner to file an expert declaration that...
We've all read it. It's an amicus brief that
essentially
is called a declaration.
Yes.
And she's a smart person.
Yeah. So, no, I don't think there was any limitations on presenting argument or evidence about how the statute should be interpreted. I'd like to yield the rest of my time to the temple.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Gail Mountner of the Lane Powell Law Firm. We represent Temple DeHurst Sinai, which owns and operates the cemetery. There's less and less of my presentation as a result of the court's questions, but I would like to point out that our interest here is not to argue the factual allegations back and forth, just as we feel that the court's interest is not to argue the factual allegations back and forth. The public policy of the legislature, when it adopted both 160 and 200 at the same time with the same hierarchy, should be that they would be construed together and that there isn't that level playing field of equities that Ms. Braun argues for, in which the court examines the quality of the marriage or determines who has the better plan. In fact, the notice and the procedures for extraordinary circumstances. A cemetery has to close and has to give notice. And in fact, in the Bellevue Masonic case, all of the heirs, it was long since after the pioneers had died and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren were all that was left, all of the heirs had consented to the disinterment. What was being debated in Bellevue Masonic was the court's equitable powers over organizing the reinterment. And so in that sense, yes, there was language in Bellevue Masonic about the court's equitable powers over the procedures of reinterment. That does not suggest that 200 should be read any differently than the Seeligs and Temple DeHurst Sinai read 200, that we hope the court reads 200.
Do you read 200 to confer any particular right on the cemetery? Veto family concerns?
It's an interesting question because obviously Judge Rule had some issues with and concerns about that. I think we argued that where the cemetery and the surviving spouse, the person with the primacy, were in agreement, one didn't have to reach that because that's the facts of this case. In Bellevue Masonic, where the cemetery initiated it, disagreement between the cemetery and the people in their order would have to be resolved by the courts.
But what if we had a circumstance here where the family was in agreement and the cemetery didn't want to have anybody coming up and digging anyone up? We hadn't disrupted the lawn in 30 years, and we don't want you doing it now.
Well, I think the cemetery has the same interest that the legislature did in the finality of burial arrangements. The cemetery has both a practical interest in not digging things up unless there are extraordinary circumstances. And if a family came to the cemetery with extraordinary circumstances and they were the people with primacy, I can't imagine a circumstance in which the cemetery would object. We have the pre-statutory case in which the Hertzel case, in which the cemetery, for reasons unexplained in the court decision, objected to a unified family's decision, and the cemetery lost that case. But again, we have no cases offered by appellant in which the person with primacy and the cemetery are aligned, and the finality, the public's interest in finality, has been overturned because somewhere lower on the cemetery believes they have a better place.
Would hear the cemetery abide the decision if the family agreed?
I think so. Well, it depends on what you mean by the family. We follow the statutory hierarchy. If the parents, who are, as someone said, two clicks down, were in agreement with the surviving spouse, we wouldn't have an issue. If the surviving spouse and the parents are in disagreement, we must, as a cemetery, following the statute, align ourselves with the surviving spouse.
Okay. That's helpful.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The legislative history regarding the statute and the statute itself say nothing about abrogating the common law.
But it clearly does. The common law refers to next of kin, and the statute creates a hierarchy that divides up the next of kin into that hierarchy.
And
those can't be the same thing.
Well, the statute still gives parties the ability to, why would there be an ability to reinter individuals if the court didn't have the equitable ability that it has based on the common law? And I think what the big picture that is missing here is the right of the surviving spouse ends at interment. But when there are circumstances like there are in this case.
Why would the legislature require the surviving spouse to pay the costs of internment forever, but only guarantee her internment for a day?
I don't think that's what the statute says.
The statute certainly does say that whoever opts in under this hierarchy is responsible for the cost.
Right, a one-time cost.
Yeah.
Not a perpetual fee.
Well, that's what you buy. You don't get, I mean, I'm not being flippant, but it's
them.
Not a month-to-month tenancy. It's into perpetuity. And the cost that's assigned assumes that. And the legislature requires the burden, that requires the bearing of that burden, financial burden, by the person who exercises the choice. And it doesn't make sense to me that there would only be a choice good for a day with the imposition of a cost for more than a lifetime.
Even under the facts and circumstances in this case.
Under any facts or circumstances that arise with these parties.
Under that analysis, no one would ever be able to reinter remains.
If someone had violated the statute 160 and how they interred in the first place, if the surviving spouse was dead or incompetent, if the surviving spouse were dead or incompetent and there was a dispute among the next class authorized, if there were some extenuating circumstances with respect to the cemetery, there are plenty of circumstances in which it would happen. But under the common law and under the statute, there is an extreme presumption of finality. The duty vests, the rights vest on 160. And, you know, we're just trying to read 160's vesting as it relates to the scope of 200. Thank you. The next matter this morning.